Board of Pharmacy, in my opinion, has been very bureaucratic and dragging their feet when lives are at stake.
Frustration around the slow pace of getting overdose prevention medicine to the public. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, September 27th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an international Arctic science gathering at the White House.
The Arctic is a foreshadow, it's an augury, it's a preview of what is coming our way in the rest of the world.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Scores of people have died in Alaska from heroin and opioid overdoses this year that the drug naloxone, also known as Narcan, could have prevented. Governor Bill Walker signed a law 6 months ago to ease access to the life-saving drug, and the bill's advocates are frustrated that the regulatory barriers the law was supposed to knock down are still up. As APRN and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports, the new rules are still more than a month away.
Senate Bill 23 sponsor Johnny Ellis, an Anchorage Democratic senator, says he's frustrated with the time it's taking to write the rules.
The Board of Pharmacy, in my opinion, has been very bureaucratic and dragging their feet when lives are at stake.
Ellis wrote in a letter to Governor Walker dated September 2nd that the Alaska Board of Pharmacy should move faster. The law gives pharmacists the ability to independently dispense naloxone if they complete a training program. The rules that are being written would implement these parts of the law. Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development officials working with the Board of Pharmacy say the board is following the law. They laid out a timeline that would lead to the final rules in November. Department Division Operations Manager Sarah Chambers says the board is gathering public comment on the rules.
This isn't a rubber stamp process that the law requires the board to follow. It requires them to give thoughtful consideration to both the dispensation standards and the training program standards.
Michelle Morgan of the Juneau-based organization Stop Heroin Start Talking says she'd like to see the Board of Pharmacy adopt emergency regulations. This would allow the board to issue rules before the public process is over and to later make changes based on public comments.
It's important for people who not only are using drugs like heroin off the street, but even people who are using prescription opiates to have that and to empower that family or the mother or the friend to be able to save that person's life.
Naloxone reverses the effects of opioid overdoses, but Chambers says the idea of emergency regulations wasn't raised until the rule writing was well underway. She says the Department of Law advised against it. The bill did issue guidance to pharmacies that said they could comply with the new state law and dispense naloxone before the rules are finalized. But Ketchikan pharmacist Barry Christensen says pharmacies aren't likely to dispense naloxone without a prescription from a doctor or other prescriber until the rules are done and the training is available.
The number of pharmacies that are going to have it available, are going to be very limited until everything gets completed on the regulatory part of pharmacists being able to prescribe and dispense.
A separate track for advancing the use of naloxone is moving forward much faster. The Department of Health and Social Services was awarded a 5-year, $4.5 million federal grant to buy, distribute, and provide training to use naloxone. Andy Jones oversees the naloxone program for the department. He's chief of rural and community health systems. The program would allow drug users and their family members, as well as law enforcement, healthcare providers, and others in contact with drug users, to have access to naloxone with training. Jones says the state received the grant 2.5 weeks ago, has already ordered its first batch of naloxone doses, and wants to have the drugs available by mid-November.
You know, we have an aggressive schedule. The reason we have an aggressive schedule is because once naloxone's in our hands, it doesn't do us any good at the state to be holding on to it and waiting to build a program. It's intended to go to the local jurisdictions so then they can hand it and they can provide it actually to the general public.
The state had 83 prescription opioid overdose deaths and 36 heroin overdose deaths last year. Jones says overdose deaths are likely higher this year, although an official count isn't available. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Anchorage police have charged a former Anchorage school district employee with embezzlement. The charges come after a five-month investigation. APD Fraud Division Detective Tony Pate told reporters today that the suspect, Kelly Fagan, allegedly took between $50,000 and $60,000 in school district funds from two schools.
It was pretty complicated. The forged checks were as part of a dual signature check system that the school district uses. She forged both signatures for that, and that was verified when we talked to the people whose signatures were allegedly on there.
Pate says 61-year-old Fagan used her ASD procurement card and forged checks to reimburse herself for purchases, voided computer deposit records to hide theft, and moved money from one account to another through forged checks. She has been charged with four felonies: scheme to defraud, theft, falsifying business records, and forgery. The thefts occurred between 2010 and 2016. When the fraud was discovered, Fagan was a Gruning Middle School financial data clerk who collected money for student activities. She had also worked at Central Middle School and was alleged to have embezzled funds there as well. ASD Superintendent Dr. Dina Paramo says the suspect does not represent the school district's 6,000 employees and likens the thefts to insider trading.
When someone steals from people in Alaska, from school districts, they steal from classrooms. As our budget is 25% paid for by local citizens and 75% paid for by the state, they're stealing from the city of Anchorage and they're stealing from the state of Alaska.
Paramo says the school district is undergoing a business process review and is moving toward an accounting system for student activities that will be available online, which will generate electronic receipts. The thefts were discovered earlier this year during an audit. Once the fraud was discovered, it was turned over to APD's fraud unit. Fagan was immediately placed on administrative leave and was terminated in April. Cabinet members and high-ranking science advisors from 25 governments will convene on the White House tomorrow to discuss the Arctic. It's billed as the first-ever White House Arctic Science Ministerial. The aim is to pool science resources from around the globe to better understand the rapid changes in the Arctic and also what those changes mean for other regions.
The Arctic is a foreshadow, it's an augury, it's a preview of what is coming our way in the rest of the world.
Mark Brzezinski is the top White House liaison to the Arctic.
The sooner and the more effectively we get in front of that scientifically, the better off we all will be.
One of the themes of the meeting is the need for better and more coordinated observation in the Arctic. Brzezinski says that includes traditional knowledge from indigenous people.
After all, they are the first people of the Arctic. They, more than anyone else, can report on changing patterns, whether flora or fauna or weather or ice.
Among the attendees are representatives of the Athabascan, the Gwich'in, the Inuit, and Sami people. 30 Alaska Native leaders met with U.S. delegation today to air their concerns and priorities. Former Alaska Lieutenant Governor Fran Ulmer, who now chairs the U.S. Arctic Research Commission, says countries well beyond the Arctic are sending science ministers to the conference.
You have countries from Italy and India and China coming because they're not only willing to contribute scientists to this work, but understand that what happens in the Arctic is really impacting them in terms of sea level rise and mid-latitude climate change.
Documents from the ministerial will be posted after tomorrow's meeting on arctic.gov. Ulmer says they'll include two pages from each country summarizing the Arctic science they're conducting. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Sandhill Cranes getting a bit too urbanized.
Now I have had people stopping me in the post office, calling me on the phone and saying, "What's with the cranes marching down the middle of roads in the middle of Homer?"
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
October 4th is REAA Election Day. Polls are open at 8 a.m. until 8 p.m. You will be voting for REAA school board candidates. When you go to vote, bring identification. If your name is not on the list or you don't have ID, you may vote a question ballot. The question ballot updates your voter registration. If you need language or other assistance while voting, ask the election board or bring someone to assist you. This message sponsored by the Division of Elections.
Every year, billions of dollars are lost to illegal fishing around the world. A new satellite-based surveillance system makes it easier to track illegal fishing, but some fishermen in Alaska aren't ready for Big Brother watching their every move. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Zoe Sobel has more.
Worldwide, overfishing is a huge problem. Jacqueline Savitz, vice president of the conservation group Oceana, says the populations of big fish like halibut have dropped 90%. But the fish can rebound when their habitats are protected.
We actually see fish stocks coming back and getting to levels where they're sustainable so that we can continue to live off the interest, if you will, and not fish down the principal. But we also have a problem with illegal fishing. It's about a $23 billion industry globally.
Now there's a new tool for people who want to prevent illegal fishing, Global Fishing Watch. It's a free, web-based, interactive map of the world's traceable commercial fishing activity, dating back to January 2012. It's based off information gathered from vessels' automatic identification systems, or AIS. The boats broadcast a signal, including their location, who they are, and where they're headed. Not all boats have to use AIS. Currently, the International Maritime Organization only requires it for large vessels, like big ocean-going cargo ships and certain vessels on international voyages. While AIS technology has been around for a while, this is the first time all of its information is publicly available. As ocean traffic increases, Jacqueline Savitz hopes Global Fishing Watch will increase accountability. She points to Alaska's waters as an example.
There's a lot of change happening up there with the change in climate and potential new shipping routes through the Arctic and through the Bering Straits. And there are going to be areas that are being protected. How are we going to know if they're really being protected?
And that's what this project hopes to do. But fisherman Roger Rowland doesn't like the idea that everyone can track his vessel. He wants to protect his fishing hotspots.
My salmon fishery, I don't want people knowing where I am. And since I'm not legally required to have it, I turn it off.
Rowland owns a 58-foot seiner based in Unalaska. Because his boat is small, he isn't required to constantly run AIS. Even though Rowland likes his secrecy, he thinks Global Fishing Watch could be helpful for certain fisheries.
When I'm pot cod fishing, I do have legal areas where I cannot go. It's not about fishing there. My boat cannot go inside a ring around a sea lion rookery. And so this is good for that. Nobody's sneaking in there because somebody's watching.
John Amos is the president of SkyTruth, a nonprofit that uses technology to highlight what's happening in the environment. He says even though fishermen like Rowland might not want to be tracked, there's a benefit for people who play by the rules.
People care about where and how their food is being produced. Here's an opportunity for fishing vessel captains to create a personal relationship with their consumers at the seafood market or at the restaurant table and say, look, we are the good guys. And we're going to show you.
There will always be fishermen who turn off their AIS. But Amos believes Global Fishing Watch will help crack down on the amount of unregulated and unreported fishing and empower individuals who want to monitor patches of ocean they care about. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Zoe Sobel in Unalaska.
Areas of Fairbanks continue to struggle with wintertime smoke pollution. Many residents of the interior community rely on wood heat. And as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, a North Star Borough-sponsored conference is exploring ways to reduce emissions tied to serious health problems.
Fairbanks has been a federal non-attainment area for the tiny airborne pollutants and smoke known as PM2.5 since 2009. The community is embroiled in a maze of state and federal air quality regulations that are about to get more complicated. In town for a North Star Borough Air Quality Conference, Environmental Protection Agency PM2.5 team leader Justin Spinillo says the community's failure to sufficiently lower pollution levels is triggering its reclassification as a serious non-attainment area.
It'll need to meet the serious area requirements, which include some more stringent requirements, most notably BACT and BACM, meeting the best available control measures and best available control technologies.
Spinillo says reclassification also moves back a compliance deadline to 2019, or even as far as 2034 if the community applies for and receives extensions. North Star Borough Mayor Carl Castle says the community should not rely on federal regulators to drive a solution.
This is a local issue. We're breathing the air. EPA isn't breathing the air.
The borough has reduced wood and other smoke pollution through education about clean burning and subsidized replacement of older stoves and boilers. But borough and state air quality consultant Bob Dulla says some neighborhoods continue to suffer serious violations.
The very high concentrations that have been recorded in North Pole in particular demand very large reductions. And so that requires a real change in behavior. That's not easy to accomplish, and it's going to take time.
Tacoma, Washington provides an example of a community that successfully reduced fine particulate pollution. Puget Sound Clean Air Agency scientist Phil Schwarzendruber told Fairbanks conference attendees that it hinged on enforcement patrols carried out after hours by local government employees.
Who are accustomed to this sort of work. Some of them were inspectors, some of them were housing inspectors. We actually had some dog catchers.
Schwarzendruber says identified violators were contacted and offered help.
If you simply cooperate with us, go through the educational materials, sign up for our alerts, sign up for the text alerts, enroll in our changeout program, the fine would be waived. And so the vast majority of people actually had no fine at all because they agreed to work with us.
Schwarzendruber says Tacoma lowered local fine particulate pollution enough to meet EPA standards in 2015. The Fairbanks Borough Assembly is taking new steps to address the problem here. Last month, the Assembly approved funding for more localized air quality monitoring. Mayor Castle says that should help identify polluters.
We have staff that will be going out and taking a look at what's going on and trying to pinpoint sources that need to improve. And I think we can get there.
The Fairbanks Assembly appropriated nearly $300,000 to purchase and operate 26 new air quality monitoring devices. The borough's air quality conference continues through Wednesday. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Every spring, hundreds of sandhill cranes visit Homer to mate and nest. They're often found looking for tasty morsels along the shoreline or silently strutting across a backyard. For the last 13 years, Ketchmack Crane Watch has organized a sandhill crane count to keep track of their population. KBBI reporter Shayla Farzan has the story.
A sandhill crane looks and sounds like a modern-day dinosaur. They stand about 3 feet tall and have a 6-foot wingspan. They use their sharp 4-inch beak for probing in the dirt and catching insects and small mammals. And sometimes they use that long beak for defense.
That beak is a very, very lethal weapon.
That's Nina Faust. She's the co-founder of Ketchmack Crane Watch, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the conservation of sandhill cranes.
I think they're very majestic birds. A lot of people have described them as regal. They kind of move like royalty, and they're just very elegant. And when they dance, it's just the most gorgeous thing you've ever seen.
A flock of 20 lesser sandhill cranes forages in a grassy field at Inspiration Ridge Preserve in Homer. Faust points to a group of 3 cranes standing close together.
You can see a family right there. The adults have red on the top, and they have a yellow eye. And the young are totally golden colored with no red top and a black or dark eye.
They're getting ready to migrate 2,400 miles to their overwintering grounds in Sacramento, California. But before the cranes leave in mid-September, Faust has a job to do. Every fall, she organizes a citizen science survey of the crane population on the southern Kenai Peninsula. On three specific days, residents contact her to report sandhill crane sightings. Using this information, she's able to estimate how big the population is each year. Habitat loss and predation can have a big effect on the crane population, says Faust. Around Kachemak Bay, bald eagles are a constant threat.
It's interesting to watch, too, because sometimes they'll see the eagle way off in the distance, and then they'll start giving this little growling call, and everybody stands up and looks, and then they all get ready. And if it gets closer, they're gone.
A large-scale die-off of common MERS seabirds in early summer attracted bald eagles to the Homer area. Faust says that many of the eagles appear to have stayed behind and are now preying on other animals, including cranes. Another potential hazard? Humans.
You almost never see them on roads, but this year there's been a problem because someone who lives on a busy road and their yard is right on the edge of a busy road started feeding them, and they showed up, and then they've been starting to walk all over the neighborhood, and it hadn't been a problem because I've never had any complaints, but now I have had people stopping me in the post office, calling me on the phone and saying, what's with the cranes marching down the middle of roads in the middle of Homer?
Cranes strolling in downtown areas risk getting hit by cars. They can also fly into power lines.
Gosh, they get panicked off. They can fly right into them. It breaks their wings. It can rip their beaks off. Just a horrible death.
Despite these threats, this year's survey showed that the sandhill crane population in Homer is holding steady at about 200 individuals. The population produced 47 babies this year, but only 30 survived to the end of the nesting season. That's about normal. In early September, the sandhill cranes left Homer and headed back to California's Central Valley. Faust and her fellow craniacs watched the last cranes depart for the year. She says this time of year always feels bittersweet.
It leaves a big hole in your heart.
In California, Bart McDermott is eagerly awaiting the arrival of the cranes. He manages Stone Lake National Wildlife Refuge, just south of Sacramento. He says the cranes start arriving in early October.
Well, you start to hear them first. If you're fortunate enough, you can hear kind of their prehistoric sounding cackle.
The cranes roost in wetlands at night and go out into neighboring agricultural fields during the day to forage for grain. But McDermott says the cranes are facing a growing list of threats in the Sacramento area.
Unfortunately, there's also a lot of urban development, so we've seen a lot of these fields that cranes, you know, typically go out and forage in start to be converted into housing developments.
The ongoing drought in California also poses a risk to cranes.
In order to have a wetland, you need water, and you need a lot of water. And the birds also rely on the farmers having water to be able to grow those crops. There's also concerns of wildlife diseases. You get smaller areas where you have higher concentrations of birds roosting in water, and there's the risk of disease communication and outbreaks.
The cranes will remain in California throughout the winter before heading north in late February. For now, craniacs and Homer will have to wait until spring before these graceful giants return to nest. In Homer, I'm Shayla Farzan.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. As an Alaskan, you love your salmon, but do you know the things you can do every day to make sure they're here for your children's children? Well, find out what you can do to ensure healthy runs for future generations of Alaskans at salmonproject.org/20ways. This message is sponsored by the Salmon Project.
In August, representatives from Shaktulik completed a strategic management plan to protect their community from erosion and violent storms. Like many of Alaska's coastal villages, Shaktulik is threatened by climate change. The plan lists 9 critical actions, including replacing the health clinic, reinforcing the berm, and building an evacuation center. All of these critical actions are part of the village's larger goal of remaining at their current site rather than relocating.
Yes, we will stay independent. We're going to take on those storms. We're going to do what's necessary to stay here.
That's Kirby Sukiak. He's the community coordinator for the Native Village of Shaktulik, and he's a member of the working group that has been drafting the management plan in Shaktulik and Anchorage since May of 2015. Sukiak supports the plan because he says the storms these past few years have felt more dangerous than ever before.
I've seen logs thrown up in the air from my house. When you see some big logs being thrown up in the air by these storms, it is frightening to some people here in Shaktulik. I've seen houses that have been boarded up because they don't want the logs to break their windows.
Sukiak believes it's impossible to understand the strength of the storms without witnessing them firsthand. He has hosted visitors from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and the Denali Commission, but he encourages more state officials to visit.
We want people in high places to come down and see what we go through, because we're the only ones that are living here, and they'll have an idea, well, what could we do to help these people?
Currently, Shaktulik does not have sufficient funds to complete the proposed projects. Sukiak hopes help will come in the form of state and federal funding. A dead puppy, a blood-splattered window, and a threatened family remain after a violent incident in Neposkiak over the weekend. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
According to a police affidavit, Alexei Ivan, age 22 of Neposkiak, smashed in a puppy's head and threw the body against the bedroom window of his ex-girlfriend and her husband. The impact splattered blood across the glass. When the puppy hit the ground, Ivan left a threatening note with a racist slur on the body. The puppy belonged to the ex-girlfriend and her husband and was usually on the porch and Arctic entryway of the home. The husband's aunt reported the incident Saturday to the village public safety officer and told the officer that Ivan had threatened her nephew before. At the beginning of the summer, Ivan had spray-painted a derogatory statement on her nephew's tool shed. When the incident occurred, the ex-girlfriend was out of town, visiting family upriver. She told the officer she was scared to return to Neposkiak, afraid Ivan would kill her 7-month-old baby. She says while she and Ivan were dating, he told her if she ever got pregnant with someone else, he would kill the child. Ivan has been arrested and charged with 2 counts of stalking in the second degree, 1 count of criminal trespass, and 1 count of animal cruelty. He has been remanded to the Yukon Kuskokwim Correctional Center in Bethel. Reporting in Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Zoe Sobel in Unalaska, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Shayla Farzan in Homer, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, and Lauren Frost in Nome. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 directory for older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
Alaska has one of the highest suicide rates in the nation, but together we can change that one life at a time. The Statewide Suicide Prevention Council has the resources and training to prevent suicide and support healing for individuals in need. Be the one to ask if someone is thinking about suicide and connect them to help. Visit StopSuicideAlaska.org to learn more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.